Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Security's Security Confidential. Today, we are honored to have Daryl Donnelly join us. Daryl hails from our neck of the woods in Dublin, Ohio. He is a VP of security and IT over at Outcomes. They're a great medical company. He's going to enlighten us a little bit about that, but he has a ton of experience. You know, he's been involved directly in the field of cybersecurity in many different roles as a tester, developer, architect, building end user solutions. So, you know, Daryl is going to give us a lot of ideations on things and that we should be looking out for as we are all on this journey to make our own environments more secure. And with that, you know, in his spare time, when he has it, he enjoys sports and he enjoys tinkering with technology like blockchain and digital assets. So we'll try and dive into some of those areas as well with him. But Daryl, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Manoj. It's good to be here. It's nice to be able to come on and talk with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the pleasure is all ours. So since we're all in the same neighborhood, and it's ironic, I've not heard of Outcomes and we're probably in the same zip code. So if you could give us a little background about your company.
Yeah.
What is Outcomes?
So as you said, so basically Outcomes is a technology company that builds software solutions in the healthcare space. So we have different solutions for end user patients, for pharmacies, for manufacturers, for pharma. Where it really originated is a spinoff or a merger of two companies. So in July of 2023, we merged from Cardinal Health, or about 500 people was a business unit outside of Cardinal Health that merged with another company called TDS Wow. Clinical. And okay. So now we're right around 800, 900 people and coming together, kind of similar synergies around focus on the patients and focus on making our healthcare system processes better through technology.
That's fantastic. So are you guys handling patient data then?
Yes. Lots of patient data. We deal with it day in and day out, yes, on our platforms.
So unfortunately, you have a target on your back then.
Correct, yes.
You guys are in a very high-risk sector.
Yes.
And we'll get to that in a second then. So let's put a pause in that one and let's, you know, how did you end up in cyber then? Like you've done so many things. What was your journey like getting here?
Yeah, my journey is interesting because, like as you already said, I started out as a software developer, computer scientist, building software for mostly end users. We had the privilege of doing consumer-based type products. I'd been doing it for about 18, almost 20 years, and then we started building a security product, which was interesting because I hadn't done as much, but I knew what basic, you know, I was aware of, some better practices, engineering practices around building software. But really what kicked it off is my buddy and I went to lunch to a lunch and learn. And we went to this lunch and learn kind of really looking more for a free lunch probably than we were, you know, we were also interested in the technology, you know how that goes.
Yeah.
And we're there and the guy started hacking into his box and showing us all these vulnerabilities of how easy it was to escalate privileges, to get data that they didn't need. And my buddy and I were like, looked at each other like, wow, this is interesting, you know. And so we went back to the office and needless to say, within like 45 minutes, we'd hacked into about four or five of our systems that we'd used, reported those. We're good. We reported them to the companies and said, hey, you know, we were able to escalate our privileges in like 15 minutes on this product. But really, it really got me kicked off and had a passion around security from an application perspective, because as a software developer, you want to build quality software. So really, it really started for me, this is an education problem. This is an awareness problem, because no developer I've ever worked with, Ben myself, would want to build software that was easy to get a defect or get a workaround. And so that really kicked off my passion and interest to how do I help software developers understand security better?
Wow. So And now in your current role, are you still working with development teams in securitizing products?
Yep. So now, I mean, I have a team, but certainly as a technology company building software, it's a good fit for me from that perspective. Now, obviously, I have larger responsibilities in compliance. And over the years, I've learned compliance and other frameworks and other things that are important. But still, really, if you get back to the root of my passion, it is really understanding software development. I like to build things, but I want people to build them securely as an end user consumer, whether it's my PHI data that's in our systems or yours or your family's. I want it to be secure. I don't want the bad guys to be able to get to it, and making sure the developers understand, hey, you know, don't just do the happy path. There's a lot of bad guys out there or threat actors that are trying to get to our stuff, and we got to defend against them.
Yeah. So, you know, that comes up with, there's so many questions in this arena then, you know, when you look at, see, software development, there was an era, at least in my era, where we would actually write our own subroutines, and we would, you know, use the standard C libraries. People even remember what those are. But from my era to today, things have changed so much. We're using so much open source.
Yep.
And so many of the basic functions we're just not even building. We're just including them in. So how do you then, when someone's managing, especially PHI, you know, and health information, that there's a lot of bad guys that want it, how do you manage that third party that you're borrowing, essentially, if that's the right term, into your development side?
Right. And that ends up becoming a pretty big piece of what the work needs to be, right? Understanding your software composition, what all's getting pulled in when you're building a project today, right? That's something that's really changed over the years, right? In the old C days, C++ days, I knew what I was including. I had libraries. I imported them very specifically. Now with open source and Java and other things, you pull in libraries and you have no idea. There could be 150 different dependencies that get pulled in that really aren't that easy to find. So we leverage tools that are out on the market. So some are commercial available tools, but there's also OWASP has like a dependency a generator tool that also can help. So there's other some free tools out there too. But it's important that you're continually scanning your code bases for third parties and making sure you're managing that and making sure the teams are looking at like when to upgrade it, making sure they're planning that into their sprints or into their software development process for sure. And a lot of the bigger ones too, we'll even watch the communities. We want to make sure the communities, even, you know, as people are identifying stuff, even before kind of the CVEs get identified or put out into the wild.
I guess that brings up the question of the role of threat intelligence in software development. I'd love to get your perspective. Is there, you know, traditionally threat intel's tools are very much viewed as a SOC, you know, item.
Right.
But is there a real place for them in the software development world?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think it's expanding and get more, as to your point, over as the evolution of open source and using other third parties. A lot of times in the older, right, as you probably remember, when we use a third party library, we would buy it. It was commercial available. You would buy it. You'd roll it in, right? If you're doing a before .NET, or, you know, some C++ or some C library, you'd buy it or you'd build your own. Whereas now, you know, you're going out on the web, finding a community and, oh, wait, this helps me do this. And so people are leveraging that. And really, you need to be managing those communities as best you can, as far as monitoring them, looking for, you know, getting reports on bugs and things, but also using other third parties, because it could take a lot of time to do that as you're using a lot more open source.
So, you know, the stakeholders, the folks that are writing the checks for some of these development projects, how do you get them to understand, you know, there's always this pressure of getting the MVP, the minimal viable product out the door, but that may not be a very secure application that could have dramatic impacts if it is the source of a breach on the profitability and future of the company, right? I mean, what has your personal experience been in that arena? Do these stakeholders understand, or is it still very much an item of friction?
I would say it's still an item of friction. I mean, the old days, it was always testing, right? Hey, if we're behind the schedule, we'd start cutting out testing, right? Which is probably a bad idea. Well, not probably. It is a bad idea. Well, I would say today that security's fallen in that testing category. Like, hey, if I'm cutting time, I need time, make up time, let's quit doing some of our security tests, or let's quit doing some of this type of implementation around security and hardening. And that's a bad choice. So is really, I see it's all, it really varies from the culture. It's really getting with the, and this is interesting, and getting with the leadership. And really, even for me, it's getting with the managers, the dev managers that are working with the product teams, and getting them to really understand, hey, your code's going into a product that's protecting you, me, your family, my family's data. It's important. They expect us to be protecting their data. So this is not like an optional thing to do. It's not like, hey, I can cut it anytime I feel like it. It needs to be done. It's part of building MVP.
Yeah. And you're right. It's so much about culture. But the one thing that I will say, and I'm looking for this exception, you know, when push comes to shove, you're absolutely right. It's testing or security, or, you know, just let's include it, this component, and we'll deal with it.
And deal with it later, right? As long as we can upgrade it, or if it's a website, web app, you can always update it. And yeah, that's a conversation I have many, many times. There's no silver bullet of how to solve that problem. It's putting pressure on them, getting them to understand, educating them, and getting leadership to really, really understand the importance. And obviously, not to go into the law, right? But Change Healthcare adds a lot of information and all their visibility and challenges they have. I wish them the best. But those help us in our industry to realize this is a real thing. I mean, this isn't something that I'm making up.
No. Trust me, given some of our experiences, you're absolutely not making it up, right? And unfortunately, right, it comes to a head when things really go wrong. That's
correct. And that's too late, but that's what happens.
That's what happens. Another question here in that arena is, well, actually there's two questions. So the first one is, what about reverting back to developing some of those libraries? And I know it's a pain. I know it would be, but then you know the content of it, and reduce your dependency on open source. Or is that completely a non-viable, dead on arrival?
I guess it really, the conversation will come down to, if it's not your core business value, it ends up being a tough discussion because, hey, I want to spend my resources and my people's talent on our IP or our intellectual property or our real value as a business. And so when these other things are out there, it's too easy to grab them and start pulling them in, but it does add risk 100%. So pulling some of it in, if it's reused, it's our value. I see some of it, but in more and more, it's, hey, here's a library, let's pull it in. Which one should we pull in for sure?
Then what about, the second part of that question is that, you know, there's been talk in the federal government about having legislation that would hold the software developer accountable for a breach if it's a result of their product, application, embedded system, as the case may be. What are your thoughts about that?
That's an interesting concept because, and once again, one, the government stepping in, I have lots to say about that, but
please do.
Would it raise the bar? Yes, potentially. But I'll tell you what, the way teams are run today with their tight deadlines and business-driven deadlines, you would lose a lot of software developers because they would not agree to it. They would know better. It's like, hey, I'm not getting proper time to build the software. I'm kind of forced to, from the environment perspective, to put in little or, you know, use the most. But I think it'd be very interesting if the government did that. It would be a huge change to the culture and the way we develop software, guaranteed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the implications are far reaching. And this has been talked about.
Yep. They've been talking about it since I was coding, because they were talking about having tests, government tests for developers, having them more responsible, like a, you know, legal, like you said, like a lawyer or a doctor. You know, we'd have to carry liability insurance then. I mean, it's just it's amazing to think. I don't know. It's be huge change.
Well,
part of your hiring practices would be how much liability insurance you have as part of the developer.
Yeah, sure. Well, that falls in the area of malpractice, right? I mean,
correct.
It would end up there.
Yes.
Well, I think the good news there is that given the state of our Congress today, I don't think anything's getting passed anytime soon that's going to be that controversial, but it's certainly right. been discussed in committees.
Correct.
And it's been on the table. And I don't know that our legislators actually understand the extent of what that would involve.
I would agree. Very few of them do. And quite honestly, really, if you really want to get change, it's probably put, and I know there's been a lot happening around that, around the board, executives really starting to get more liability around a breach or an incident. And I know that's a challenge too, but they're the ones a lot of times that are helping fund and picking, you know, and so making sure they're getting proper funding and quality talent working on a product is important.
Absolutely. So I want to get your thoughts on, in the general world of cybersecurity, you obviously, this is a top 10, right? What we run into is, I don't know how many people even get the top three right. Forget about the top 10. I mean, what's the foundational issue, do you think, in our industry that's still leading to so many breaches? We're still not able to get the foundational hygienes in place.
Yep.
I'm not picking on you, by the way, Daryl.
No,
it's a more general topic here.
To me, I think it's two. I think there's two main issues. I think it's education, which I haven't looked recently, but I did more research about 10 years ago. I was looking to go get my master's. The number of schools that even taught cybersecurity, now it's changed a ton in 10 years. But even go look at how many programs, like computer science programs in college, even teach security coding. It's increased a ton in the last 5 years, I would say. But even that's foundational. In school, you're taught to get a lab done. You're not taught to make it right, good code, secure code. So that's one area. That, to me, is a big foundational piece. How we're teaching our developers what's the right thing to do. The second is really having proper time and leadership understanding it's not an optional capability. This is our consumers, whoever that may be, could like us and patients or hospitals, or just you and I using a mobile app on our phone.
Sure.
I expect it to be secure. And so it's not an optional requirement. Why would I, if you put in the Google Play, an app on my Android and said, yep, this app isn't secure. Well, I wouldn't install it. I don't care how much it was free or not. I would never install it.
See, I think you're probably an exception though, Daryl. I bet you a lot of people would install it because.
Well, if they think it does what you're right. You're right. It's once again, from a consumer, as far as, I guess if we made it more public that it wasn't secure, I think more and more the media is doing marketing and the general public. Cause I get more and more questions from just general people around security now than I ever did. So, but you're right. If it meets my needs, people want convenience over security. That's for sure.
That's right. I think, you know, on the education, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but I think this is partly the challenge we have as a security industry. People want convenience over security. So I've always tell my teams, we need to make the easy button the secure button. And I know that's not always easy.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, but security and usability doesn't always have to be contradictory.
No, it doesn't, but it adds that there's a time factor and a cost factor that goes.
Correct. Exactly. To do it right, to do it. Yes, 100%.
Even there, you know, there is a point of diminishing returns, right? I mean, Daryl, where we, again, my data on this, developing, you know, very specialized tools way back in the days, in the 90s, late 80s, 90s, that was just dated beyond belief. But, you know, what's the best way to put this? You know, security at that point in time was never really a big concern for us. You know,
correct.
When we wrote that stuff, it just wasn't there.
I mean, I was oblivious to security 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in general. It was more about secure. It was more about defensive programming was the term. Make it defensive, make it hardened programming. It wasn't really secure. And they're not the same thing. They're similar, but they're not the same thing.
But if we go back now and we revisit some of that code, because a lot of that code is still, you know, there's still DOS code in the Microsoft operating system that's in.
Yep, okay. I do. But scary.
If we go and address that, is there, where's the point of diminishing returns? Because how far, how much time and money do you invest in it? Because foundationally, it seems like, well, it's not that it seems like, I would argue that it is. That if it's developed by a human being, it's foundationally flawed because we're not perfect beings, correct. Right? So everything correct. We produce has correct. Some flaws in it, right? So as a result, you know, where is that line? At what point do you say, okay, it's secure enough given the current threat levels? And how would you assess that risk? And
well, I think you have to address it based on risk. And just like any other defect that you fix or don't fix in your code, it's risk, right? Whether I'm doing a fixing this button the way it looks or color, that's a risk. The customer is going to complain. Or if I click that button and I can do a SQL injection because of it, that's a risk. It's way different levels of risk on those two incidents, right? So you need to look at it from a risk perspective and really talk through it and make sure they understand it. But I think having that discussion is difficult today if people don't even understand the implications of security or understand what is good security. Because to your point, it's never going to be 100%.
No.
I mean, I know there's some philosophies out there, and they've done some of it, right, where you can do mathematical formulas and do more scientific engineering methods for each method, and there's ways to do it. But even then, it's flawed. There's always going to be – is any humans involved – it's flawed, potentially.
I am so glad to hear you concur on that. Because that's, I think there's, the public has that misconception. And for, I know a lot of our listeners don't, but if a layperson is listening, there is no such thing as 100% cybersecurity. You can't.
Correct. Well, right, exactly. Cybersecurity is a tough road because it only takes one flaw for them to get in. I could have 99.9% of everything covered. It only takes that 0.1%, one little line of code that someone made a mistake on, and they're in.
Exactly. And you may never even find it during your own testing because it's something esoteric that you wouldn't normally think of it in the QA process.
Correct. Yep.
Right.
And that happens a lot. I mean, that's pretty common because you're never going to test everything.
No.
Just like functionality, you're always going to miss pieces and edge cases on functionality. But they could turn into security incidents.
Right. And the other side, the bad guys, I mean, that they're probably the ultimate QA testing department, right?
For
sure. Because they're going through not just your code, but everything surrounding it. And they're looking for a break in the process somewhere, just somewhere.
Correct. They're looking for a crack. No,
exactly.
Yep.
So it's not 100%. And I'm glad. Thank you for concurring on that, because that is something that we get a lot. It's like, well, why did you guys just make it secure? Well,
right.
You know, even like for us, we're a managed security services provider. And we actually even put it into our contracts that we can't, it's not 100%. We can't get, nobody can get to 100%. But at least in our instance, the goal is to make it so difficult that the bad guys are like, well, there's enough other companies like this. Let's go find somebody else.
Right. That's what layers of defense bring into play. Right. I mean, you have to have layers and layers upon layers, and software development's the same way. You need layers. Some of those are infrastructure layers, but some of those are actually in the layers need to be in the code themselves.
So let me, that's a good segue into another area I'd love to get your feedback on. Is if you look at, I don't know if you've seen the SANS Institute, their investment scale on cybersecurity, where they have prevention on the left-hand side, and they recommend everybody starts on the left-hand side, and then they go to the extreme right with proactive cybersecurity, proactive. keeping in mind that a lot of people who listen to this are small, medium businesses with limited resources.
Yep.
Where on that continuum, where do you make your biggest investments? What's the best bang for your buck to create a secure environment? What would your advice be to folks?
Yeah, it's hard to make a stereotypical. I mean, it's hard because each business is a little different, and that's where I would bring in and evaluate that. And I would really want to understand your risks, but I would agree you would start in the preventative side and start building up your foundation. And then once again, whether it's compliance, whether it's your response team, you know, really it's what your business is where you're going to focus first, whether you're a software development company, or if you're not a software development company, maybe it's your vendors that are your biggest risk. And how do you build up your vendor process and program? And so, and the right level of spend in each area is not the same for everybody, even in all the same healthcare. I mean, you put us in even verticals. I don't think it's the same for everybody. You have to kind of decide based on your risk and what your clients expect, but also where the risk for your business is.
So would it be okay to paraphrase and say, you don't want to start with the technology first? You need to kind of get your house in order.
100%. Technologies are always helpful, but if you don't have a good process defined, if you don't have administrative controls first, putting technologies behind those aren't usually very effective. Throwing technology at a problem doesn't solve it usually, because if they're not implemented properly, if there's not processes around to handle what you find in your technologies, they're frivolous. So you got to make sure you're hitting all three from a technical control side. From a control side, not technical control side. People, process, and technology.
In your own career, then, can you give us insight into a particularly challenging security problem you've encountered, and what have you done with it?
Which one to pick, I guess, is a good. I think one of the biggest ones I've been running into for the last 10 years is really around more of a single pane of glass.
Okay.
As I'm working with my teams, and I'm working as a team, so basically the security team and like the development teams, how do I get to a single pane of glass to have a clear message to, okay, here you built this software. Here's the vulnerabilities that I've identified through tools, testing, pen testing, you name it. What's the most important three things that you need to fix in your next iteration? Getting to a single pane of glass where all the tools and processes and outputs are all disparaging and different kinds of data, and it ends up being a bunch of manual steps to bring import the data and show it. So to me, that's one thing that I've been, like I said, it's been a problem I've been dealing with for over 10 years, really. It's really probably close to 15 years, but trying to narrow down and give, because as you're working with the development teams, they're used to a single backlog, a single set of here's the storyboard, or here's the cards I'm going to work on, here's the requirements. Well, security hasn't done a great job of saying, yep, here's the five things you need to do. There's more, but here's your top five. Go fix these first. And because there's so many different tools that give them information and they get overwhelmed. And so a lot of what I've spent time with is consolidating that information out by risk, and say, okay, here's 1A, 1B, and 1C. Do these three things. And you need to know how to do it. Let's talk about it. But here's what you need to fix first.
And you said you do it by risk. Are you getting everybody on the same page with risk? Or is that something that's done more in isolation? And you're just saying, okay, this is what.
Yeah, currently it's more done in isolation. Because they don't, over time, we've matured the risk program a little bit more to help them get input on it. But in general, when I first start working with the team, okay, there's 150 things. Some are critical, high, medium, low, all the way, whatever. It's always about what's the top three, what's the top five. I found that development teams, any team really, as you're working, you only need two or three things. Focus on that, get that done. Then let's go to the next layer. Giving them 50 things overwhelms them, and they start spinning out of control and they don't know what to do.
Do you see a role for AI in the solving of this problem?
I do. I do. I definitely think AI will help. I think it's more common export formats and AI that can definitely help for sure. Definitely.
What about on the QA side? Do you see changes happening there with AI potentially where
you Yeah, that's interesting. I think QA definitely can be, I mean, AI can do a lot of different things. I mean, you still have to train it, right? And be very clear. Honestly, even just doing, basically testing, you know, basically writing unit tests as you're writing your code, and just some of the culture changes that's happened over the last few years on that, where you basically write, you know, or tested driven development, right? Where people are writing their tests first, even before they write their code. Those things could help and really start getting people to think about what the output should be. And really the other big thing that I taught when I talk to teams is once again, back to our training, as at least when I was in college, and it's been a while, but is more about the happy path. It's always about the happy path.
Right.
So really get into a team and talk about what's the malicious path. What's the error path? You need to be thinking about these because this really happens. And if you don't include those in the happy path, your code's not going to hold up to some kind of attack.
And oh boy, that's a big problem. Okay.
Yes. And that's part of our training. That's part of the culture. That's part of time. There's lots of pieces into that.
And I think, and this is where I'll go. I'm on the advisory board of some universities in their computer science department and one of my things that I've been trying to get people to listen to about this is that it's not just enough to teach good coding, but we need to be teaching about how the mind of the bad actor, what are they thinking about? How do they think when they're attacking code?
Correct.
And, you know, to date, the only organizations that I've seen that actually have a really good program around that are in our federal agencies, you know, you know, those guys are absolutely into psychological warfare, understanding what's going on. And then how do you compromise? How would we be compromised and how would we compromise someone?
Correct.
But that's not a part of any university program right now, at least in the 48 continuous United States.
Interesting. Yeah. See, that's too bad. Cause I use threat modeling exercises for that.
Okay.
Really? So a lot of times I've done table talks, threat modeling exercises, and it really, not always a lot comes out of it from a output other than it's really a training exercise to bring the whole development team in and talk through them exactly what you just talked about. Okay. Let's map out your data flows. Okay. What I'm going to do this. I'm a bad actor. I'm going to try to get to that. Can I do it? I'm going to start attacking your thing in different places. What are you going to do? How's your code going to react? And then asking them, how would you attack your code? If you knew you wanted to get to this piece of data that's critical, whether it's a key or password or PHI, whatever it is, what's valuable in your system? How would you get to that if you were a bad actor and wanted to just get through it? And a lot of times they can tell you, it's like, oh, well, we know we have this skeleton over here. And if you do this, you do this. Yep. I'm like, okay, there's a threat. That's a problem. That's what a threat actor is going to do. They're not going to do the happy path and be nice.
No, not at all. They're going to be thinking very laterally.
Correct.
In order to move laterally.
And very complex too.
Oh, absolutely. These technical problems are not trivial, but
correct.
Then the adversary is not your run of the mill criminal either.
Right. Right. Correct. Right. I mean, these are trained people that this is their profession. That's what people, other thing that good education to talk about, right? In a lot of places, these are their profession. So think about it. If your profession to attack software, how would you do this?
Well, you have thousands of PhDs at the GRU in Russia who wake up every morning to find flaws.
Yep.
I mean, that's a hell of an adversary to go up against.
Bingo. Yep. For sure.
That's, you're making it and their job is to break it.
Right. Correct.
Well, you know that could you put a college curriculum together around that topic? I
don't know. I haven't thought about it. I've thought a lot about it. We need it. I haven't thought about that to level potentially. That'd be interesting. I could definitely
get you an audience if you could. Yeah. If because this has been a passion of mine personally. is getting,
like I said,
into the mind of the bad actor.
Correct. Yeah. I think, like you said, I mean, one of the root problems is the education, and we got to fix that. Not that that's going to solve all the problems. It's not, but at least people coming out of our education programs will be aware of bad actors, be aware they're out there, how to defend against them. And obviously it evolves, so you got to keep learning, but that's a huge win to be able to give them to even know that it exists. I mean,
what about end user behavior in all this, right? I mean, that's a big gap as well that creates, I mean, a lot of times when code is being developed, I'm not sure that the development team has a view of how a user is going to interact with it, but they really don't know how they're going to interact.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that's one thing we're doing. One of our philosophies and one of our philosophies with outcomes is to get more exposure to development teams on how users are actually using their software, which is very important. It really helps enlighten them, you know, not just product managers as well, but the development teams themselves want to sit there and watch someone watch their software. That's a very interesting thing. That used to be more traditionally just UI, UX, usability experts would do that. And so now it's expanded, like, hey, you need to understand how they're using it so that you can, it helps you really connect and how you're coding it and how you're making the workflows and things like that. So yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. And find gaps, because you know what? The user is going to find a way to get their job done.
Right.
Period.
Efficiently as they can. I mean, over time.
Yeah. And they're not going to let technology get in the way of it.
Right.
You know, they'll try the shortest path. If it doesn't work, then they'll try plan A, B, C, D and you see it all the time where people and users discover gaps. Hey, you know what? If I click this and do this, it actually lets me in and lets me shortcut this. And maybe that was never a spec.
Yep, exactly. Right. Yeah, definitely used to be with special key combinations or things like that in the old Windows desktop days, or, you know, a desktop app. It's like, yep, oh, wait, you have that shortcut. They're going to use it. Boom. They've jumped three screens.
I would bet you a dollar, Daryl, that there's probably still key combinations and things like that that you could find in software that's floating around there.
Oh yeah.
Just look at SQL injection. We've known about that forever on websites, right?
Yep, 1998.
How many, just reading of the breaches, how many SQL injection hacks have we even seen in the last year? Forget about the last decade.
Yeah.
So it's still happening.
Right. And that's, exactly. That's basically, I use that as our litmus test of like, hey, we're not where we need to be. 1998 was it discovered over 20 years ago, and it's still happening. And it's really not that hard to remediate if you know what you're doing. It's really not that hard to remediate.
Yeah, but you have to.
But you have to do it very deliberately and do it right. Yeah.
Not hard code certain things into your code.
Correct.
And you're passing it to your database. Yep.
Correct.
I'm not going to get deep into it, but you know, another thing on the reporting of bugs and vulnerabilities. One of the things we've seen, like in the state of Ohio, the Secretary of State's office actually gives you leeway that if you hack them and you tell them how you hacked them, they won't press any charges.
They won't press charges.
They won't press any charges, right?
Yeah.
Is that generally a good idea? Is that something more of a policy position we should adopt across the nation that says, look, if you find a gap, report a gap? Because right now, if you go to the TSA website and you go hack it, well, you're going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. The problem, yeah. It's interesting because you certainly need, the more testers we can get, the more eyes, the more creative people, the more you're going to find. And so, yes, we should encourage people to report them, obviously. The problem is, thinking at the other side of it, is now I'm trying to defend that website. How do I know it's a good person or a bad person trying to hack into me? And so if they go ahead and get in and don't report it, now what do you do? Well, then I don't know. It's just an interesting behavior to potentially reinforce.
Okay, so if they're not a good person and they get in, I mean, how is that different from an incident response plan today?
Right. Yeah, it's true. I guess treat them like a threat actor and issue them, right? And then all of a sudden, they come. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a tree. But I agree with you that more eyes, more creative people are going to find more things. And so we should definitely incent them to report them effectively.
Yeah. I mean, right now in, so many industries, like, you know, I'll prick on the legal profession for a second. Those guys don't want to know if they necessarily have a lot of vulnerabilities in their environment,
right?
Because once they know about it and they don't correct it, they're liable by default. Whereas we met all the compliance checks, you know,
right.
And we have proper procedures
that we're followed. Yep. Yeah. But once again, just because you don't know about it doesn't mean you're not vulnerable, but it's certainly from a liability, it changes liability.
That's right. And is it any different on the healthcare side?
Not really, but the other side of it with HIPAA, high tech out there. You still have that regulation you're dealing with. So if someone does disclose information through a vulnerability or something, you're going to be dealing with that anyways. It doesn't matter if you knew about it or didn't know about it. It happened. You're going to have to deal with it. So a little bit, maybe.
Daryl, how do we get compliance to actually benefit security? Like,
I would argue that it does benefit some to a point. This is the challenge. To a point, it definitely benefits because it can raise the bar. It can make a common ground on the bar. The other side of it is it can potentially also be twisted as good enough, and it gets confused with security. That's the challenge. Compliance and security are not the same thing. Do they overlap? Yes. The biggest thing that I've seen compliance do in my career is really help up the bar on processes. Really around documentation of processes and more administrative controls. How effective some of the technical controls are, yes, it's helped some, but once again, there's a diminishing return. You get to a point, and then after that, you're more focused on the compliance than on what really security is.
That concurs with our experience very much.
And that's why it's tough when the government has to step in or do something. It helps raise the bar initially, but overall, it ends up being not as secure in the end.
Yeah, because you look at all the major corporations that have been breached. I can assure you that every one of them met every compliance that, or they definitely have reports that prove that they were compliant to whatever standard.
They could get through an auditor.
They get through an auditor.
Yep.
But a hacker still gets in.
Correct. Right. And it's back to, I could protect 99.999 and it's only that 0.001 thing that's not protected. The hacker finds and gets in. That's the diminishing returns. That's a tough, yeah.
In the medical world, do you, if we were to categorize breaches as those being caused by technical vulnerabilities that have been exploited versus social engineering, where do you think that balance lies and where is it going in the future? And I'll give you the example. Like Okta recently, they had MGM, I think they had a breach, and it was the help desk. You know, that was a socially engineered.
Yep.
It had nothing to do with the software per se. It was a process hack, right?
Yep.
So where do you, on that threat landscape, where do you see, where's your experience saying this is going to go? Where?
I think that's a great question. I and I'm just, so I think with AI and all the deep fake stuff, I think that's going to be our next challenge for social engineering. I think it's already not even, it's going to be, it's already started.
Oh, yeah.
So you're really going to have lockdown. And we've even looked at and started reviewing some of our processes around how would we defend against that? What our processes hold up against that? Because you're going to see that more and more, right? You're, you know, as they're doing it. I mean, the typical scenarios, yep, your grandson's on the phone saying, I need money, and I'm in somewhere in some country that can't get out to his grandmother, right? And I need that money. And it sounds exactly like him because they have his voice faked. So what do you do to that? It's a tough problem when people want to help. People want to do the right thing, but they have to have very tight processes and follow them always.
Well, there was that bank in Hong Kong where over a deep faked Zoom call, the fella sent $25 million of the bank's money, right? So yeah. Not only did they fake the voice, they actually faked the
video. Yep.
I guess 25 yep. million reasons is a lot of good reasons to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, once again, the money drives the solutions. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's obviously technical vulnerabilities are still always going to be there. You're always still going to have to fight with them. I would say even some of this in my thought, and once again, I don't know, some of the other nation states, it's a little more challenging for the social because their accents are pretty common, things like that. So you may be easier to defend against it, but the AI stuff that's going to come out is what's going to be the tougher stuff. And then there's always going to be technical vulnerabilities because there's no, like you said, like we started out, there's no 100% secure software. So you have to look at mitigating controls all around it and build software throughout to be secure as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Daryl, we're coming up on the hour. We want to give you a couple minutes to talk about whatever it is, plug whatever it is you'd like to do. So, you know, you have the mic. I'll stop asking questions. Let our listeners know whatever you'd like to let them know about.
Yeah, I don't really have anything special, specific. I mean, to me, it's still, you know, this is a great industry to be in. It's still, we're chasing our tails a bit. We're not mature as we need to be to really defend against the threat actors. We need to keep plugging away. And I always tell my team, this is a marathon. There's short sprints within that marathon always, but we got to keep running the race and continue the marathon, protecting your company, protecting your person every day and when you get out of bed. And that's what it ends up being. So don't, keep fighting.
Now, Daryl, do you participate in the Columbus B-Sides or any of the local conferences?
I have some. Yep, I have. I've got ISSA, things like that, and some of them, yeah. Over time, as time permits, I do, yes.
That's the key part. Is there any that you're going to be appearing at, or if someone...
I'll be at the Central Ohio ISSA here in May, where I'll be going, and I'm going to be on a panel, application security panel.
Oh, fantastic. If anybody in our audience wants to hit you up with anything, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, I'm old school. I'm not on social media, so you could send an email or hit me up on LinkedIn is probably the best way.
Okay.
Is really the main social media that I use.
And speaking of social media, I do want to take this moment to remind all our listeners that if you like what you're hearing and like what our show does, please hit the like and subscribe button. Let us know about it. We know we have a large audience, but you just got to reach with your hand and click that little
right
that little button.
Bump it up.
But Daryl, it's been a pleasure. I would hope, as time goes on here, you're always welcome back. Anything that you want to let our audience know about, would love to share. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for inviting me. It's nice to be on and chat with you about some pretty important topics.